Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. We have a great show for you today. Our guest is Dr. Rex Jung. He's a clinical neuropsychologist and professor at UNM Med School and a renowned brain scientist and researcher at Albuquerque's Mind Research Network. Rex Jung, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Later in the show, I want to talk with you about your area of focus, creativity, and how it differs from intelligence and what we've learned about creativity from brain scans. But first, one preliminary question about you. What led you down this path?
Well, it's a long and winding path, and my undergraduate degree is actually in business, in finance, and I did work in that area for...
So you could have been a rich quant if you'd
exactly,
have gone the other way.
If I'd stayed in that area.
Right.
But I worked in that field for a few years and started volunteering at Special Olympics and working with people with intellectual disabilities, and became interested and fascinated, frankly, about what was going on in the brains of those adults that I was working with, coaching basketball and volleyball and track, what was going on in their brains. So really swerved quite dramatically into wanting to do that type of work, wanting to work with brain issues. I didn't quite know at the time what that was going to look like, but I quit my job and started working in a sheltered workshop for people with intellectual disabilities. Started graduate school in clinical psychology a little bit later, and then really found my niche in neuropsychology, which is between neurology and psychology, which is this discipline that looks at brain-behavior relationships. So the interaction, the interplay of human behavior and the brain networks that underlie that human behavior.
And that's what it's come to. And has it been sort of a winding path, or has it been sort of straight down that
Boy, it's felt pretty indirect. I finally popped out of I entered graduate school about 28 and popped out of graduate school about 10 years later with my degree, so it doesn't feel very direct.
Let's talk about your area of focus, creativity. First of all, I guess what is creativity? How would you define creativity?
So I define it the way the experts do. I'm not an expert yet, but I'm studying it, and this definition has come down to us through, I don't know, several years, perhaps decades, as the study as the creation of something novel, the production of something novel and useful within a given social context. So let me kind of take those pieces. So the production of something novel is important. It has to be new. It has to be novel. It has to maybe be surprising. This is an important aspect of creativity. But the other side of the coin is its usefulness, its utility. So this interplay of novelty and usefulness is an important dynamic interplay of the creative process. It's also testable. It's a definition that allows us to put this notion to a test, and that's important.
So how does creativity differ from intelligence?
So intelligence is the production is problem solving and reasoning. And the way I think about the dynamic interplay of what the brain is doing with intelligence, it is problem solving out in the world in a fast and accurate manner. So you think of evolutionary constraints and challenges from the environment, lion growling or something growling behind a tree, or you hear a growling noise, you have to make a decision very rapidly, whether that's a lion or whether that's a motorcycle or whether that's your child. You have to do that in a rapid and accurate manner in order to survive. So it's a very adaptive characteristic of the brain to do things rapidly and accurately. That's the dynamic interplay. With creativity, it's a slower process. It's a different process, and it's a process where you are putting ideas together that wouldn't normally come together in a rapid way and sometimes in an inaccurate way. So you can have errors and trials in this creative process, trial balloons that don't work, there's no particular evolutionary cost to this other than you have to try again. So it takes more time to do this. So it's a different brain process to do something creatively versus to do something intelligently, which has some real world costs if you
so,
do.
So let me ask you this example. You mentioned sports earlier. So you may have watched the Super Bowl like almost everybody else in America. Yeah. And so Eli Manning goes back You know, he's got 3 seconds. He's trying to figure out where the double coverage is, who's single covered. He decides to throw into the double coverage to Manningham. You know, Manningham catches it, and basically he wins the Super Bowl that way. Mm-hmm. He makes this incredible decision. That's one. And then we have Einstein somehow coming up with, in his E equals MC squared, that, you know, the speed of light squared. Mm-hmm. Both of those seem to me, I mean, I don't know how to define those as intelligence or creativity, or they seem to involve both, actually.
Yeah, sometimes they're mixed up. When you describe Eli Manning, that sounds more like a intellectual process to me, something that has been practiced, and it almost happens automatically, that he can rapidly and accurately go to the right person in spite of all the different things going on around him. It's so over-practiced, it's so highly ingrained that intelligence is perfectly ingrained. Now, Einstein coming up with his theory of relativity is a different process. All that expertise and all that knowledge has to be in place and practiced to a certain extent. But then there's this new thing that emerges from all those ideas, and this new thing is the special theory of relativity, and it has never been seen before. You see that in athletics as well, when athletes do these incredibly creative moves. When Michael Jordan does this, or you know, I think of Julius Erving, which is from a different era, when someone blocks him in front of the rim on one side, so he goes completely under the basket, does a reverse layup, and no one's ever seen anything like that before. And it's a creative maneuver that is beautiful in its execution. So there is creativity in sports, there is intelligence in science, and there is some back and forth between intelligence and creativity.
It also sounds like you can sort of practice and learn creativity from what you're saying.
I think so. I think unlike intelligence, which seemed to be much more under genetic constraints, creativity, I think, is something that can be learned.
And so can we teach it? Is that something we can teach, and is it something we are teaching?
It's part of the goal of the research that we're doing, is to uncover some of the critical underpinnings of creativity, that if there are some particular elements that we can that facilitate creativity, then yes, you could teach it.
So one of the things, one of the real criticisms, for example, of a modern day education in the United States is like teaching to the test.
Yeah.
And now that strikes me as the opposite of teaching creativity, but maybe it isn't.
In my estimation, teaching to the test is not conducive to one type of creative cognition. Now, let me qualify that. So you need the raw materials to do creative work. You need the facts. You need the details. You need stuff to do creative work with. So the information has to get in there. So getting the test material in there is important. If you don't have any raw materials to work with, you're not going to be able to do something creative with them. So that being said, however, if it's just pushing in raw materials at the expense of not letting them percolate and meander around in a way that produces something novel and useful, that seems like a lost opportunity.
So how do we get teachers to have students percolate around?
Well, I mean, my favorite class was recess, so that's one time.
I enjoyed that myself.
That's one time that you have an opportunity to play with ideas, but the downtime is important when your brain is not in acquisition mode, when it's in consolidation mode, when it's in a thing we call transient hypofrontality, which can be achieved in lots of different ways. But a bath, a long walk in the woods, meditation, yoga. People achieve this transient hypofrontality, this relaxed cognitive state in lots of different ways. But recess is one of those, where you're being playful, where you're playful with ideas, where you can let things jumble together and come up in interesting ways.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest Dr. Rex Young. Dr. Young is a neuropsychologist and a brain researcher at the Mind Research Network. And Dr. Young, one question I have about creativity is, it seems to involve, in my mind, more than just this. It seems to also involve personality or attitude.
You're
because
exactly
it seems
right.
to because you know people laud Steve Jobs, for example. They say he came up with all these creative ideas, but one of the things he did was insist that these ideas go forward. Or if you take
it's quite an SOB, wouldn't he?
So apparently, the more you read, the more you learn about that. And I guess maybe quintessentially Darwin, who you know came up with evolution. He knew he was going to be incredible. He himself, I think, had gone to divinity school. His father had been a minister. He knew he was going to be incredibly criticized for this. He stuck with it, and you know, hence we have evolution. So it seems to me that creativity. Actually, to be effective, there has to be something more than just your own mental process.
This is an extraordinarily important point, and these personality variables are something that we're studying. And what you're getting at is persistence. This ability,
that's a better word for it.
This ability to persist and persevere in spite of opposition from a world that might not want to hear about all your great ideas about how to change things. I mean,
the world typically doesn't want to hear all these.
Not right out of the box. I mean, now everyone wants an iPhone. But but at first, Steve Jobs was out on the outside looking in. He got fired from some jobs. He really had a tough go of it. He was able to achieve success before he died, thank goodness. But there was a lot of opposition, a lot of persistence and perseverance that he had to undertake before he succeeded. So this personality variable is incredibly important. So intelligence, creativity, persistence, perseverance appear to be the three ingredients, if you will, for successful creativity.
This is like one main topic of our economic conversation, and the implication seems to be somehow we become a less creative, less dynamic, less, we come up with fewer great ideas anymore in this country. I don't know if that's true, but assuming it is true, then you know, what do we do?
Well, a couple of things that I've talked about already. I mean, the pushing ideas in at the expense of not having time to allow them to combine in novel and useful ways, I think, is a mistake. The self-esteem movement has been an abject failure.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are feeling enormously high in self-esteem, but not able to handle rejection well and real, honest criticism. And that tendency not to put ideas out is important. Another aspect of highly successful creative individuals is putting lots of ideas out there.
And you've got to have lots of ideas to come. I think there's some great quote is, you know, you've got to have like, I don't know, 100 ideas and maybe one of them will really be good or something. I can't.
Linus Pauling says, in order to have a good idea, you have to have many ideas. Right. And so that is a good adage in this way. And, you know, when I sit I shouldn't name names, but when I sit in some meetings with young people and people are called on, there's a reticence, a reluctance to put one's hand up and try out an idea because you don't want to look stupid, you don't want to.
But that's always true of all of us. So do you have any sense that it's less true of America today than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Or
I have some sense of that, and I have some data because I give talks to lots of different groups, and so when I give the same talk with the same problem, let's say, to different groups, I have hands shoot up in a slightly older cohort that looks a little more like you and me, and people making mistakes and laughing it off. And in the young cohort, it's dead silence. No one wants to risk being wrong, looking stupid.
So I want to ask you another thing about creativity, because we tend to associate, at least the popular culture tends to associate creativity and genius with actually mental disorders, particularly manic depression, what used to be called manic depression or bipolar disorder. And there's some very famous people that have had bipolar disorder that are renowned for their creativity.
Sure.
So first of all, do you think there is some kind of association between sort of creative genius and bipolar? I mean, Van Gogh, my favorite artist, I mean, seems to be from the letters from Theo, that he was seriously disturbed and may have been seriously disturbed when he did these great works in Arles, for example.
For every instance that you can cite of an individual with depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, who exhibits creative capacity. There are wards and wards full of patients who do not express creative talent. So this is what we call neuromythology. It would be nice to believe that there's some hidden genius in mental illness. And there's a grain of truth in there. There's some interesting association between this frontal lobe looseness, and the capacity to spin out novel ideas. And you see that at its extreme in the word salad of a patient with schizophrenia. There are hundreds of individuals who don't express this creative capacity for every Van Gogh, thousands, millions. And there is no instance of that I know of people doing their best creative work in the throes of a manic event or in the throes of a depressive episode. It's always between episodes that they're doing their creative work. It's not by virtue of the disease as it is manifested at its worst. It's always between episodes that they're doing their creative work. So it's a very important distinction to make in this case.
So when, you know, I read Kay Redfield Jamison a long time ago, and she's
the most famous, or one of the most contemporary famous examples. Yeah,
yeah, and she's also, I think, a psychologist.
She herself has bipolar,
and I guess what you're saying sounds like what she described. I mean, she might have been heading toward manic when she was performing so well.
Exactly, but it's extrapolating from an instance to making a broad generalization, and that's what we try not to do in the neurosciences. it's very tempting to do that. And again, there's a grain of truth there because there's some – I mean, in our research, we found in one of our studies in precisely the same place that you see lack of frontal lobe integrity in our creative individuals, you see lack of frontal lobe integrity in bipolar subjects in precisely the same place. Wouldn't it be, you know, voila? Wouldn't that be a fantastic happenstance? But you have to be very careful not to extrapolate too far.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and our guest today is Dr. Rex Jung. He's a clinical neuropsychologist and professor at UNM Med School and a renowned brain scientist and researcher at Albuquerque's Mind Research Network. Just one more question on this line, because it seems to me that brain science and brain scans, and you just alluded to it, would be perhaps very helpful in looking at abnormal mental behavior as a sort of first rung to, and I guess that's what started you out in the whole field.
Sure. And I study schizophrenia, and I study lupus, and I study multiple sclerosis. I study different diseases. So it gives me the benefit of not making those generalizations, because I've tested and scanned and seen patients with very severe mental illnesses, and I've am testing and scanning and seeing my subjects with who are creative that do not possess these characteristics. And there's something profoundly different going on in the behavioral characteristics of someone who is psychotic versus someone who is creative. And that's what we're trying to understand. It's very early days, and we're trying to understand what's going on in the brain of these two individuals, for example.
So are you looking specifically at neurochemical reactions in the brain of people with abnormal mental patterns?
Yeah, I predominantly use structural MR magnetic resonance techniques, which includes looking at brain biochemistry, looking at the chemical signatures of the neurons and the glial cells, the glue that holds the brain together, the axons, the wires that communicate between different processing nodes of the brain, and the myelin, the the insulation that surrounds those wires that allows that to conduct electricity accurately and rapidly between different modules of the brain. So I look at the biochemistry, I look at the integrity of that insulation and the wires through a different technique called diffusion tensor imaging, and I look at the actual structure of the brain, the cortical thickness, so the processing modules of the brain. How thick is that? Because we know that when people are using different parts of their brain more, it beefs up like a muscle in different regions of the brain. So it increased cortical thickness in some regions of the brain, cortical thinning in other regions of the brain can be associated with different cognitive capacities. So those I use mostly structural techniques as opposed to looking at you thinking in different parts of your brain light up that those functional fMRI techniques. I tend not to use those as
you
much.
You don't use it. So you're not having, in general, people perform tasks and then looking to see what parts of the brain light up when they perform tasks.
In general, no. I like structural techniques because it is the cumulative effect of the environment written into your brain over time. With functional techniques, they can change whether you've had caffeine, whether you've smoked a cigarette, whether you've had a good night's sleep, you know, all sorts of certain imaging parameters. If they have the lights going too bright or too dim, it can change the functional characteristics of your brain, but the structure doesn't change.
So you look at the structure and then you already know the characteristics of these people. For example, they would have taken a test for creativity, or they would have taken tests for IQ, or
exactly.
They'd already been diagnosed as having MS or some other problem, and then you correlate them.
Yeah. So we just do, I mean, you know, most simply, if we have two groups of people, we look at the differences in their brain between, for example, someone who's a group that's highly creative and a group that's less creative, average creativity, and we look for differences in their brain. Does the structure of their brain, does the cortical thickness or thinness of their brain differ between the highly creative and less creative individuals? Does the wiring look different in their brain using diffusion tensor techniques? Does the biochemistry look different?
And yes, does it? Does
it does. All three look different.
And really?
We published papers to that effect. That
in some way that any of us could understand?
Yes. So the crib note, the basic story is that with intelligence, more is better, almost invariably. More cortical thickness in certain regions of your brain.
More gray matter?
More gray matter, more wiring,
more
and thicker
everything.
Wires, and more biochemistry in certain regions of your brain. More is better.
And that's sort of what we believe by evolution, right?
It's building a super highway in your brain to do things fast and accurately. That's intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
With creativity, at least with our research and other groups, what we found is that less is better, particularly with the frontal lobes. We're finding that cortical thinning in certain regions of the frontal lobe is conducive to higher creativity. Less white matter integrity or lower white matter integrity and lower levels of certain chemicals in the brain, particularly in regions associated with gatekeeping, if you will, of information going through the frontal lobe, the anterior cingulate cortex, a very complicated name, but it's the gatekeeper in the frontal cortex that allows information to flow back and forth, that a little looseness in the frontal lobe is more conducive to the spread of ideas throughout the brain and the extrapolation of ideas to produce that novel, useful connection.
So that sounds kind of counterintuitive to me, because we always kind of thought that
it's a power thing.
Yeah.
No,
right.
It's not. It's subtle, and it was a bit surprising when we found this consistent story, but it holds up with a theory from my friend Arne Dietrich from American University in Beirut, Lebanon, who talks about transient hypofrontality. And this is a brain state, and we talked about this a bit earlier, where you are downregulating your frontal lobes in order to let creative ideas flow. And this is the warm bath or the meditation or a long walk in the woods. People have a variety of means to achieve this transient hypofrontality. But if your brain is a little loose to start with in the frontal lobes, it's perhaps easier to induce or to engage in this transient hypofrontality. You're going to need your frontal lobes later to hypothesis test and persist, so it's a transient frontal state. So it's just a little looseness. If you get too loose, then you devolve into mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, where it's loose all the time. And all of these disorders are characterized by chronic hypofrontality. We're talking about transient hypofrontality. So it's a very subtle transient looseness of the frontal lobes that we're finding in our studies.
What would be the evolutionary theory that would support why that occurs?
Because there's some problems out in the world that you want to solve accurately and rapidly, and you don't want to spend a lot of brain resources to do that. The brain is a very expensive organ to run in your brain. It uses something like 80% of the oxygen you take in and a ridiculous amount of blood and food and everything you take in. The brain is a very expensive organ. But there are some problems, particularly social problems, that require more time and more resources devoted to them. So this more languid process and this more frontal process can be taken offline, and more time can be spent with this to develop creative, if you will, ways to problem solve social networking problems, relationship problems, and art was the early way to link people together, and problems in the environment that you haven't seen before. What happens if there's a flood and you need to get from here to there? You need to create something to do that. You've never seen that. An earthquake, these rare events. Well, let's create gods up in the sky that throw bolts of lightning and create earthquakes and create floods. I mean, there's things that the frontal lobes can do to help organize a system so that you can go on in the world without going crazy, perhaps.
So we're nearing the end of the show, and I want to ask you a couple final things, or at least one final thing, which is, if there's one thing that you wanted to know about the brain that you don't know now, what would it be? What would be that something you'd really love to know about brain science that you don't know?
Almost every neuroscientist gets to the question of why are we conscious at all? It's not necessary to reproduce. It's not necessary to do this evolutionary thing. But why we have consciousness, why we have this ability to question our thought process and be introspective, all of that. It is totally unnecessary in order to replicate our species and move forward. Why?
So one final question. If you look down the road 10 years in brain science, if you can look that far, where do you think brain science will be?
Not much further than we are today.
I mean, it's just beginning.
Right? It is just beginning, and people are making all sorts of magical claims about curing this and solving that, and it is a really tough slog. The brain is a enormously complicated organ, and when you put genes on top of that, it magnifies the complexity by at least several orders of magnitude. So I think the fact that we're putting genetic information into the mix is going to slow us down as opposed to accelerate the process. We have lots of technology. We have lots of computational ability, but we're limited by the power of our brain to understand what it is we're looking at.
We're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Rex Young, my engineer, Joe Green, and my producer, John Burgund. I'm Stephen Spitz, and this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. Archives of my prior shows can be found at the Spitz Report, stevenspitz.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.